Chapter 68 of the Boston Herald, a letter which is of special interest in its prophecy of the new day, the dawn of which was even nearer than he suspected. Dear Mr. Baxter, another throne has gone down, and I swim in oceans of satisfaction. I wish I might live 50 years longer. I believe I should see the thrones of Europe selling at auction for old iron. I believe I should really see the end of what is surely the grotesquest of all the swindles ever invented by man monarchy. It is enough to make a graven image laugh to see apparently rational people, away down here in this wholesome and merciless slaughter day for shams, still mouthing empty reverence for those moss-backed frauds and scoundrelisms, hereditary kingship and so-called ability. It is enough to make the monarchs and nobles themselves laugh, and in private they do. There can be no question about that. I think there is only one funnier thing, and that is the spectacle of these bastard Americans, these Hamersleys and Huntingtons and such, offering cash, encumbered by themselves, for rotten carcasses and stolen titles. When our great brethren the disenslaved Brazilians frame their Declaration of Independence, I hope they will insert this missing link: we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all monarchs are usurpers, and descendants of usurpers, for the reason that no throne was ever set up in this world by the will, freely exercised, of the only body possessing the legitimate right to set it up, the numerical mass of the nation. You already have the advance sheets of my forthcoming book in your hands. If you will turn to about the 500th page, you will find a state paper of my Connecticut Yankee in which he announces the dissolution of King Arthur's monarchy and proclaims the English Republic. Compare it with the state paper which announces the downfall of the Brazilian monarchy and proclaims the Republic of the United States of Brazil, and stand by to defend the Yankee from plagiarism. There is merely a resemblance of ideas, nothing more. The Yankee's proclamation was already in print a week ago. This is merely one of those odd coincidences which are always turning up. Come, protect the Yank from that cheapest and easiest of all charges, plagiarism. Otherwise, you see, he will have to protect himself by charging approximate and indefinite plagiarism upon the official servants of our majestic twin down yonder, and then there might be war, or some similar annoyance. Have you noticed the rumor that the Portuguese throne is unsteady, and that the Portuguese slaves are getting restive? Also, that the head slave driver of Europe, Alexander III, has so reduced his usual monthly order for chains that the Russian foundries are running on only half-time now? Also that other rumor, that English nobility acquired an added stench the other day and had to ship it to India and the continent, because there wasn't any more room for it at home? Things are working. By and by there is going to be an emigration, maybe. Of course we shall make no preparation. We never do. In a few years from now we shall have nothing but played out kings and dukes on the police, and driving the horse cars, and whitewashing fences, and in fact overcrowding all the avenues of unskilled labor. And then we shall wish, when it is too late, that we had taken common and reasonable precautions, and drowned them at Castle Garden. There followed at this time a number of letters to Goodman, but as there is much of a sameness in them, we need not print them all. Clemens, in fact, kept the mails warm with letters bulging with schemes for capitalization, and promising vast wealth to all concerned. When the letters did not go fast enough, he sent telegrams. In one of the letters, Goodman is promised $500,000 out of the profits before we get anything ourselves. One thing we gather from these letters is that Page has taken the machine apart again, never satisfied with its perfection, or perhaps getting a hint that certain of its perfections were not permanent. A letter at the end of November seems worth preserving here. To Joseph T. Goodman, in California. Hartford, November 29, 89. Dear Joe, things are getting into better and more flexible shape every day. Papers are now being drawn which will greatly simplify the raising of capital. I shall be in supreme command, It will not be necessary for the capitalist to arrive at terms with anybody but me. I don't want to dicker with anybody but Jones. I know him. That is to say, I want to dicker with you, and through you with Jones. Try to see if you can't be here by the 15th of January. The machine was as perfect as a watch when we took her apart the other day, but when she goes together again the 15th of January, we expect her to be perfecter than a watch. Joe, I want you to sell some royalties to the boys out there, if you can, for I want to be financially strong when we go to New York. You know the machine, and you appreciate its future enormous career better than any man I know. At the lowest conceivable estimate, 2,000 machines a year, we shall sell 34,000 in the life of the patent 17 years. All the family send love to you and they mean it, or they wouldn't say it. Yours ever, Mark. The Yankee had come from the press, and Howells had praised it in the Dieter's study in Harper's Magazine. He had given it his highest commendation, and it seems that his opinion of it did not change with time. F all fanciful schemes of fiction it pleases me most, he in one place declared, and again referred to it as greatly imagined and symmetrically developed tale. In more than one letter to Goodman, Clemens had urged him to come east without delay. Take the train, Joe, and come along, he wrote early in December. And we judged from the following that Joe had decided to come. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, December 23, 89. Dear Howells, the magazine came last night, and the study notice is just great. The satisfaction it affords us could not be more prodigious, if the book deserved every word of it, and maybe it does. I hope it does, though of course I can't realize it and believe it. But I am your grateful servant, anyway and always. I am going to read to the cadets at West Point January 11. I go from here to New York the 9th, and up to the Point the 11th. Can't you go with me? It's great fun. I'm going to read the passages in the Yankee in which the Yankees West Point cadets figure and shall covertly work in a lecture on aristocracy to those boys. I am to be the guest of the superintendent, but if you will go I will shake him, and we will go to the hotel. He is a splendid fellow, and I know him well enough to take that liberty. And won't you give me a day or two's visit toward the end of January? For two reasons. The machine will be at work again by that time, and we want to hear the rest of the dream story. Mrs. Clemens keeps speaking about it, and hankering for it. And we can have Joe Goodman on hand again by that time, and I want you to get to know him thoroughly. It's well worth it. I am going to run up and stay overnight with you as soon as I can get a chance. We are in the full rush of the holidays now, and an awful rush it is too. You ought to have been here the other day to make that day perfect and complete. All alone I managed to inflict agonies on Mrs. Clemens, whereas I was expecting nothing but praises. I made a party call the day after the party and called the lady down from breakfast to receive it. I then left there and called on a new bride, who received me in her dressing gown, and as things went pretty well, I stayed to luncheon. The error here was that the appointed reception hour was 3 in the afternoon, and not at the bride's house, but at her aunt's in another part of the town. However, as I meant well, none of these disasters distressed me. Ears ever, Mark. The Yankee did not find a very hearty welcome in England. English readers did not fancy any burlesque of their Arthurian tales, or American strictures on their institutions. Mark Twain's publishers had feared this, and asked that the story be especially edited for the English edition. Clemens, however, would not listen to any suggestions of the sort. To Messrs. Shadow and Windus, in London, Gentlemen, concerning the Yankee, I have already revised the story twice, and it has been read critically by W.D. Howells and Edmund Clarence Stedman, and my wife has caused me to strike out several passages that have been brought to her attention, and to soften others. Furthermore, I have read chapters of the book in public where Englishmen were present, and have profited by their suggestions. Now, mind you, I have taken all this pains, because I wanted to say a Yankee mechanic's say against monarchy and its several natural props, and yet make a book which you would be willing to print exactly as it comes to you, without altering a word. We are spoken of, by Englishmen, as a thin-skinned people. It is you who are thin-skinned. An Englishman may write with the most brutal frankness about any man or institution among us, and we republish him without dreaming of altering a line or a word. But England cannot stand that kind of a book written about herself. It is England that is thin-skinned. It causeth me to smile when I read the modifications of my language which have been made in my English editions, to fit them for the sensitive English palate. Now, as I say, I have taken laborious pains to so trim this book of offense, that you might not lack the nerve, to print it just as it stands. I am going to get the proofs to you just as early as I can. I want you to read it carefully. If you can publish it without altering a single word, go ahead. Otherwise, please hand it to J. R. Osgood in time for him to have it published at my expense. This is important, for the reason that the book was not written for America, it was written for England. So many Englishmen have done their sincerest best to teach us something for our betterment, that it seems to me high time that some of us should substantially recognize the good intent, by trying to pry up the English nation to a little higher level of manhood in turn. Very truly yours, S. 50. Clemens. The English nation, at least a considerable portion of it, did not wish to be pried up to a higher level of manhood by a Connecticut Yankee. The papers pretty generally denounced the book as coarse, in fact, a vulgar travesty. Some of the critics concluded that England, after all, had made a mistake in admiring Mark Twain. Clemens stood this for a time, and then seems to have decided that something should be done. One of the foremost of English critics was his friend and admirer. He would state the case to him fully, and invite his assistance. To Andrew Lang, in London. First page missing. 1889 they vote, but do not print. The head tells you pretty promptly whether the food is satisfactory or not, and everybody hears, and thinks the whole man has spoken. It is a delusion. Only his taste and his smell have been heard from important, both, in a way, but these do not build up the man, and preserve his life and fortify it. The little child is permitted to label its drawings, his is a cow, this is a horse, and so on. This protects the child. It saves it from the sorrow and wrong of hearing its cows and its horses criticized as kangaroos and workbenches. A man who is whitewashing a fence is doing a useful thing, so also is the man who is adorning a rich man's house with costly frescoes. And all of us are sane enough to judge these performances by standards proper to each. Now then, to be fair, an author ought to be allowed to put upon his book an explanatory line. This is written for the head. His is written for the belly and the members. And the critic ought to hold himself in honor bound, to put away from him his ancient habit of judging all books by one standard, and thenceforth follow a fairer course. The critic assumes, every time, that if a book doesn't meet the cultivated class standard, it isn't valuable. Let us apply his law all around. For if it is sound in the case of novels, narratives, pictures, and such things, it is certainly sound and applicable to all the steps which lead up to culture, and make culture possible. It condemns the spelling book, for a spelling book is of no use to a person of culture. It condemns all school books and all schools which lie between the child's primer and Greek, and between the infant school and the university. It condemns all the rounds of art which lie between the cheap terracotta groups and the Venus de Medici, and between the chromo and the transfiguration. It requires Whitcomb Riley to sing no more till he can sing like Shakespeare, and it forbids all amateur music, and will grant its sanction to nothing below the classic. Is this an extravagant statement? No, it is a mere statement of fact. It is the fact itself that is extravagant and grotesque. And what is the result? This, and it is sufficiently curious. The critic has actually imposed upon the world the superstition that a painting by Raffle is more valuable to the civilizations of the earth than is a chromo, and the August opera than the hurdy-gurdy and the villager singing society, and Homer than the little everybody's poet whose rhymes are in all mouths today, and will be in nobody's mouth next generation, and the Latin classics than Kipling's far-reaching bugle note, and Jonathan Edwards than the Salvation Army, and the Venus de Medici than the plaster cast peddler. The superstition, in a word, that the vast and awful comet that trails its cold luster through the remote abysses of space once a century and interests and instructs a cultivated handful of astronomers is worth more to the world than the sun which warms and cheers all the nations every day and makes the crops to grow. If a critic should start a religion, it would not have any object but to convert angels, and they wouldn't need it. The thin top crust of humanity, the cultivated, are worth pacifying, worth pleasing, worth coddling, worth nourishing and preserving with dainties and delicacies, it is true, but to be caterer to that little faction is no very dignified or valuable occupation, it seems to me. It is merely feeding the over-fed, and there must be small satisfaction in that. It is not that little minority who are already saved that are best worth trying to uplift, I should think, but the mighty mass of the uncultivated who are underneath. That mass will never see the old masters, that sight is for the few, but the chromo maker can lift them all one step upward toward appreciation of art. They cannot have the opera, but the hurdy-gurdy and the singing class lift them a little way toward that far light. They will never know Homer, but the passing rhymester of their day leaves them higher than he found them. They may never even hear of the Latin classics, but they will strike step with Kipling's drum beat, and they will march. For all Jonathan Edwards' help, they would die in their slums, but the Salvation Army will beguile some of them up to pure air and a cleaner life. They know no sculpture, the Venus is not even a name to them, but they are a grade higher in the scale of civilization by the ministrations of the plaster cast than they were before it took its place upon then mantle, and made it beautiful to their unexacting eyes. Indeed, I have been misjudged, from the very first. I have never tried in even one single instance, to help cultivate the cultivated classes. I was not equipped for it, either by native gifts or training. And I never had any ambition in that direction, but always hunted for bigger game, the masses. I have seldom deliberately tried to instruct them, but have done my best to entertain them. To simply amuse them would have satisfied my dearest ambition at any time, for they could get instruction elsewhere, and I had two chances, to help to the teacher's one. For amusement is a good preparation for study, and a good healer of fatigue after it. My audience is dumb, it has no voice in print, and so I cannot know whether I have won its approbation or only got its censure. Yes, you see, I have always catered for the belly and the members, but have been served like the others, criticized from the culture standard. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.